still married today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A couple's home on the English coast is threatened by rising seas, so they decide to move to Australia. But
I didn't like renting a house out there because I like to do my own stuff in our house.
So, all of these things I did point out you could have thought of before we went. But never mind. We're still married. Just.
Plus, a crash in Saskatchewan claims the lives of 10 junior league hockey players. For many Canadians, this tragedy gets to the national spirit.
Everyone talks about it and everyone lives it. The rink and the kids who play on that team, they're superstars in a small town.
And if you think Americans are mad at Facebook, just ask Sri Lankans. Those stories ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you with us today. A lot happened over the weekend, and we start today with reaction to that alleged chemical attack in Syria on Saturday night. It's one of those moments that feels like it could change the direction of the conflict, and we are hearing from several people, including President Trump, that there will be a strong response. But there have been other moments like this before in Syria. There was President Obama's red line warning after a previous chemical attack, which led to some chemical weapons being seized from Syria, but not much change in the direction of the war.
Russians, the French, the Brits, the Americans, the Syrians have been let alone so that the country is destroyed. Even the Security Council, they didn't succeed. Nothing has been solved. Nothing has been done. The killing is going on and on.
That's a Syrian journalist in Damascus, but many other people who've closely followed this conflict might express the same kind of frustration. In a few minutes, the big picture of the war in Syria, but let's find out first what happened this weekend in Douma, which is in the eastern Ghouta area near Damascus. The World's Richard Hall has been following the story from his base in Beirut and speaking with people on the ground in Syria.
The offensive in eastern Ghouta has been going on since early February. And Douma is kind of the last holdout in Ghouta. It's the last town held by the rebels. And the Syrian government has been bombarding Douma for 3 days before Saturday. Conventional weapons, shells, airstrikes. Then at around 9:45 p.m. on Saturday evening, a different kind of attack began. People started flooding into medical centers showing signs of gas poisoning. And some really awful, terrible videos emerged showing some of the victims of that attack.
And do we know how many people were injured and how many people were killed at this point?
So we have rough numbers at the moment. The Syrian Civil Defense, the White Helmets, say around 500 people were treated. They counted 46 people killed, but they said there were many more. They had to stop searching because of the fumes. They could still smell the fumes. And I actually spoke to a medical student named Mohammed, who was working in a medical center when the attack happened in Douma. And he told me that he'd already been working for 3 days nonstop when the chemical attack happened.
We tried to save them, but a lot of the poison couldn't be treated because the White Helmet teams couldn't reach them and save them. They died in their homes.
So as you can hear, he's completely overwhelmed. Mohammed is completely overwhelmed. They were working for 3 days before that attack happened. He said that patients were showing all these symptoms associated with chemical attacks.
The persons who was accepted in the hospital were suffering from symptoms of dilated bubbles and coughing blood from their mouth. There were a foam in their mouth. They were in a bad neural state.
Can you just give us a little context about what's been going on in Douma specifically over the past few weeks? Like, why did the Syrian government use gas after weeks of airstrikes?
So, yeah, this is a question that many people have been asking today. Why would the Syrian government use gas when it appears to be winning? So what's been happening in Douma is that there has been one rebel group called Jaish al-Islam, and they have been holding out in Ghouta and in Douma for a long, long time. There were negotiations going on between the Russian military and Jaish al-Islam for them to remain in Douma. This is what's been reported by Reuters. And apparently the Syrian government was very unhappy about that arrangement. And according to some analysts, they sought to thwart that arrangement by essentially terrifying civilians and forcing Jaish al-Islam out. And if that was indeed the case, it seems to have worked because Jaish al-Islam agreed today to surrender and withdraw from Douma.
Yeah, but it worked at what appears to be a very steep price for civilians. President Trump has hinted that he was considering a military response with a tweet that pointed the finger at Russia and Iran. I mean, this after He kind of prematurely said the U.S. is going to withdraw from Syria last week. Is there a chance U.S. policy in Syria may change?
I don't think so. And some of the people I've been talking to think the same. The U.S. is kind of walking a very thin line. People are saying that the U.S. is likely to come up with some sort of military response to punish Assad without escalating the conflict. So that might just be some sort of symbolic strikes. It might be a repeat of what we saw last year after the attack in Khan Sheikhoun, where the U.S. cratered a runway at an airbase. And after that, everyone just kind of went about their business again and nothing really happened. And chemical attacks continued.
What happens now to the people of Douma, Rich? Where are they going to go? And do they think they're safe now that this group, Jaish al-Islam, is gone?
What's happening in Douma now is that there are around 100 buses waiting to escort Jaish al-Islam fighters and their families out. And of course, like has happened many times previously, many civilians will choose to leave as well because they fear reprisals from the Syrian government. We saw this in Aleppo. We saw this in other parts of Ghouta as well. I spoke to one resident who was leaving tomorrow. And this is what he told me.
It's a feeling of frustration. I'm leaving the city I grew up in, and I'm afraid that I probably won't be able to get back to the city. Because once the regime takes control of the area, all of the acts of violation of human rights and all of the acts that came from the dictatorship will happen again.
So many Syrians forced from their homes, Rich. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And here are Syrians who don't want to leave, and they too have to go.
That's right, yeah. And we should, of course, be thinking about what comes next for these people. This has happened to thousands upon thousands of people, civilians, who have chosen to leave their homes in Aleppo and these other places where the Syrian government has taken back control from rebels. They're being sent to Idlib, which is really the last major rebel stronghold. All indications suggest that there's going to be an equally brutal campaign to regain that part of the country, and that these same civilians will be in the firing line again, and they'll be forced to face the same airstrikes and the same attacks all over again.
The world's Rich Hall in Beirut. Thanks very much, Rich.
Thanks, Marco.
Chemical attack over the weekend and Trump's tweet about it gave you a feeling of deja vu. You now understand why. Rich was referring to a sarin gas attack a year ago last week that killed more than 80 people in Syria in Khan Sheikhoun. Trump said at the time that had crossed many, many lines, and he then ordered an airstrike on a Syrian military base. Politico's Susan Glasser wrote about that at the time and about what some saw as the Trump administration's whiplash-inducing isolationism and hawkishness. Susan Glasser joins us now from Washington. She is Politico's chief international affairs columnist and the host of the podcast, The Global Politico. Susan, do you see some consistency with Trump's position on Syria today with what we've seen in the past?
Right. Consistently inconsistent. That's pretty much the story here. It is amazing that it was basically exactly 1 year ago we were having the same conversation. Would Trump strike at Syria in response to a chemical weapons attack? And if so, which he ultimately did, what would it mean in terms of his Syria policy? And I think what happened last year gives us a guide to what we might expect this time, which is to say genuine outrage on the part of the president. Clearly, he as I'm sure with many of your listeners, is looking at those photographs, reacting to them, saying this is unacceptable. He's promised a response now within 24 to 48 hours. But, you know, my view is that even if a strike of some kind is likely, which it probably is right now, this is still the same president who just 5 days ago said we need to get out of Syria right now, notwithstanding the policy of continuing to stay there after the defeat of the Islamic State that he had agreed to with his own advisors just a few months ago.
Now, in that article you wrote for Politico a year ago, you wrote that there was one consistent thread through Trump's apparent foreign policy contradictions, and that was being the not Obama. Do you see more of that today?
Yes, I think not Obama is still a pretty good guide to at least how President Trump wants to see himself on foreign policy. In fact, he, over the weekend, when tweeting about Syria, specifically mentioned President Obama again. The connection with the current situation in the Red Line is a little bit obscure, since Trump himself last year said that chemical weapons used by Assad would not stand. And in fact, now Assad has repeated it all over again. But certainly, Trump wants to be seen in the world as acting in a way that he believes Barack Obama would not.
So last year, Trump said there was a red line, Assad crossed, and then Trump had the airstrikes on that base in Syria. When he refers to this red line that Obama set up on using chemical weapons, does that criticism force Trump now into a place where he has to respond?
Well, it certainly makes it likelier that Trump would respond. But of all recent presidents, one thing that is remarkable about Trump is that he doesn't seem to mind being called a hypocrite or inconsistent in his policy. Other presidents, as you know, had a sort of abhorrence of that, and it made some of their actions more predictable. I would say that Trump is less vulnerable to that charge. However, I would note that the point foreign policy experts have when they use the term red line is that it's meant to signal in international relations an unacceptable move that will trigger future consequences. And to the extent that Donald Trump drew a red line himself last year around the use of chemical weapons by the Assad government, well, they've now felt free to cross that not once but twice. So last year's retaliatory strike did not have the intended effect. And basically, the Assad regime has said to Donald Trump, just as it said to Barack Obama, we don't care about your red line. The United States of America can't stop us from doing this. And the indications are that that's correct, which really suggests that the diminution of American power in the Middle East, regardless of what Trump chooses to do now.
So Trump has come out now and blamed Assad and also Russia and Iran. How do you read this? I can only describe it as a more clear-eyed assessment of world affairs from the president, especially after his pulling punches with Putin and that very slow response to what appeared to be Russia poisoning a former double agent in the UK. I mean, what do you see here?
Well, I think on the one hand, it's always good, in my view, whether you're the president or anybody else, to be as clear-eyed as possible about what's actually going on in the world. And it is, as they would say, a true fact that both Russia and Iran have propped up, enabled, and boosted the Assad government in Syria throughout this long and horrible civil war, 7 years already and counting. So, you know, on one hand, it's just a statement of fact. What it's not, however, is a statement of policy. There's an implicit threat embedded in that Trump tweet, but it's not clear what kind of a threat it is, first of all. Second of all, what I'm struck by is more than a year into the Trump administration, there's just enormous confusion about what his policy towards Syria is and more broadly in the Middle East. And of course, on some level, you need to be clear about your policy for even your own side to carry it out. And, you know, you just had a situation last week where Trump has undercut what his top officials believed to be their policy in Syria, which was staying there. And in fact, actually, at the moment Trump was saying he wanted to consider immediately withdrawing from Syria, you had the head of CENTCOM, General Votel, at that exact same moment at the U.S. Institute for Peace, talking about the American commitment to remain behind and to work on reconstruction and to finish the job against the Islamic State. And so, you know, who do you believe? The head of CENTCOM, whose job it is to have thousands of soldiers in the field and to carry out a strategy, or the commander-in-chief who says, well, maybe I don't support that strategy that I already signed off on?
So, Susan, on day one of John Bolton as Trump's national security advisor, what thoughts occur to you about where all this could lead in Syria if this hawk now has Trump's ear?
Well, that's right. It is. It would be a huge and resonant irony, wouldn't it, if the very hawkish John Bolton, the new national security advisor, if his first 24 hours in office, the United States was actually bombing a country. Bolton is almost cartoonishly famous for advocating bombing strikes against a variety of countries, not just in Syria, which he did advocate last year, but also he's publicly advocated in recent months military attacks on both Iran and North Korea.
Susan Glasser, Politico's chief international affairs columnist in Washington. Thanks for being with us, as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
The problem with Facebook in Sri Lanka. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here. That's a quote from Mark Zuckerberg's written congressional testimony. Facebook's founder and CEO will be facing lawmakers in person later this week, but that is the gist of what he's expected to say, that Facebook did not do enough to prevent misuse of its platform, and he's sorry. Zuckerberg's mea culpa has come as Facebook is embroiled in a crisis that many critics say could have been avoided. That crisis includes the Cambridge Analytica controversy, which, as you probably know, involves that company getting access to the data of nearly 90 million users without their knowledge, data that was being collected for political purposes. But here's another Facebook crisis that, again, many say not only could have been avoided, but which Facebook didn't do enough to prevent. This one is far away from Capitol Hill and Facebook HQ in California. This crisis took place in Sri Lanka, and it involves riots and deadly violence earlier this year against the Muslim minority there.
The government felt that one of the inciting factors was Facebook, and so they decided to shut down social media for, initially it was a period of 72 hours, and then it went on for a couple of days more than that.
Megha Rajagopalan is BuzzFeed's Asia correspondent. She says Sri Lanka's government viewed blocking access to Facebook as a last resort, because for years before the violence boiled over, many in the country warned Facebook about extremists posting content on the platform.
These are not people who represent the majority of Sinhala Buddhists in Sri Lanka. We're talking about a handful of extremist groups that are extremely vocal, and they're posting a lot of destructive messages on social media, particularly on Facebook, which is by far the most popular platform in Sri Lanka.
Those must have been some pretty provocative messages. Can you give us an example or two of the kind of posts you saw on Facebook?
So, for example, in the days leading up to the riots and even during the riots, they were comparing Muslims to dogs. They were saying they should be shot like dogs. People were spreading rumors saying that Muslim-owned stores were trying to sterilize Buddhist women by putting sterilization pills into their food. And those posts were shared thousands of times before Facebook took them down.
Yeah, so before Facebook took them down, how aware were they that these messages were on their platform?
So I think in the immediate sense, they clearly weren't aware because they didn't take them down. And those messages clearly violate Facebook's own community standards. But the kind of broader problem that these extremist groups in Sri Lanka were using Facebook as a platform and that they were using it to spread hate speech, Facebook knew about it for years. I talked to government officials in Sri Lanka as well as academic researchers and NGOs that have recognized this as a problem from as far back as 2013. And they've documented it really extensively, and they have records of telling Facebook representatives that this is a problem and they had to address it before violence broke out. And Facebook basically didn't really do all that much.
I mean, Facebook has maintained that it takes hate speech on its platform very seriously. In some countries like Germany, it even says it's increased its staff to deal with new regulations on hate speech. What do you think went wrong in this case in Sri Lanka?
Well, first of all, I should say that Facebook has now promised to increase their staff after this crisis happened. But I think the issue in Sri Lanka is that you have a small country. It's not an important market for Facebook. They only have about 6 million Facebook users, which is really a drop in the ocean to them.
In your reporting, did you get the sense that Facebook has enough people on its staff with the right language skills to screen content produced in Sinhala?
So Facebook does not give specific numbers. However, several people that I met in Sri Lanka who were briefed by Facebook on this issue said that before March, Facebook only had two staffers that were proficient in Sinhala and could moderate Sinhala language content. So if you think about how important Facebook is to social discourse in Sri Lanka, as well as spreading the news in Sri Lanka, you know, two staffers is really not enough.
So you've also reported on Facebook activities playing out in Myanmar, where extremists use the platform to spread propaganda against the Rohingya Muslim minority. Do you see parallels between Sri Lanka and Myanmar?
Yeah, for sure. This idea that Muslims as a minority group are actually seeking to convert people and to reproduce and to take over the country, that's a common theme among extremist groups in both of those countries, Sri Lanka and Myanmar.
So Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg, they've been on this unprecedented sort of media tour ahead of the congressional hearings this week. What's been going through your mind as you read and listen to and watch these interviews? Because, I mean, they're responding to the Cambridge Analytica scandal, but in the background, there's this stuff in Myanmar and Sri Lanka.
Yeah, I think that those two issues are related. I think, of course, we are focusing on this Cambridge Analytica scandal in the U.S. because that's the thing that directly impacts us. But I think this hate speech issue is really a global story, and we're just starting to get the tip of the iceberg on this. The same pattern is happening in a lot of places. Basically, extremist groups use Facebook to put out calls for violence. Violence happens and nothing is done about it. And the cycle just repeats itself. So I think this issue with hate speech is another area where the company is going to be criticized for being less than transparent.
You think the Sri Lankan government would say that Facebook is doing enough to address issues that are relevant to Sri Lanka?
I think Sri Lankan government officials NGO workers, academics, activist groups, all of them believe that Facebook has not done nearly enough to address all of these concerns in their country. And it frustrates them because they see that Facebook is addressing these same concerns in places like Germany and the US and elsewhere in the EU. And they feel that they're not being paid attention to simply because it's a language that not a lot of people speak and it's a small market for Facebook.
Megha Rajagopalan, BuzzFeed's correspondent for Asia, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And this note, we reached out to Facebook for their response, but we have not heard back yet. Before we take a short break before the news, here's a quick update on the travels of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's the heir to the throne in Saudi Arabia. And as you probably know, he's been making headlines recently as both a reformer and a ruthless political operator eager to consolidate his power. The Crown Prince was just here in the U.S. on a very high-profile visit that included a meeting with President Trump at the White House. Now the Saudi royal is in France for meetings with officials there, including President Emmanuel Macron. My BBC colleague Sebastian Usher says the prince's visit is more low-profile than the one here, but it's still making news.
What's eye-catching are these cultural developments. Now, there's a couple of things which have come through coinciding with his visit. One is that Saudi short films are going to be shown for the first time at the Cannes Film Festival, which starts next week, and the French are going to help the Saudis set up an opera and culture centre, a national orchestra there. Very new stuff. But the big headline deal that should be done is for a massive, it's called an open-air museum in the northwest of Saudi Arabia, encompassing extraordinary sites that have never been developed, including a kind of mini Petra, the city built out of stone in Jordan. The same people who did that, the Nabataeans, did it in Saudi Arabia. It is an extraordinary place, but it's never really been developed. But certainly not for outside people to come. Now, this will be a massive multi-billion dollar project. This is just the beginning of it, but it is another sign of the ambition of the Crown Prince.
The BBC's Sebastian Usher reporting there on Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his visit to France.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's a fact of life. Attorneys are expensive. You're likely to pay around $300 an hour. That's just one reason why smart business owners turn to LegalZoom. In fact, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out with things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews. LegalZoom created their business legal plan to help you get legal advice for your business from vetted, independent attorneys and tax professionals available in every state. You also receive access to NDAs, lease agreements, and more. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Instead, you just pay one low upfront price. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan today and get special savings when you visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. In Thailand, 8 out of 10 women in prison are there for drug possession.
We put a lot of people in jail, but it seems that we're losing war on drugs. My question is that, should we legalize drugs?
Is Thailand's American-style war on drugs a failure? That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Last week on the show, we heard that the number of women in prison around the globe is rising. Back in 2000, women and girls made up 5% of the total world prison population. That went up to 7% in 2015. And the two nations locking up women at the highest rates, that would be the U.S. and Thailand. In both places, the majority of women behind bars are there for nonviolent offenses like drug possession. Today, The World's Patrick Nguyen takes us inside one of Thailand's most crowded prisons, where Thai authorities are starting to question the policy of mass incarceration.
I'm on the far outskirts of Bangkok. Picture banana trees, quiet streets, simple homes made of cement. I've come here to meet a former inmate whose name is Ging. I've decided not to reveal her full name to protect her identity. Ging takes me to a deserted swimming pool, a discreet place where she says she's going to show me how people in Thailand smoke meth. Apparently, it requires a few items from 7-Eleven.
So you need three things. A cigarette pack, a lighter, and the drug. What you do, you see this, like a cigarette pack, you take the foil out.
Now she's folding up the foil, like origami, making it into a boat. Looks like a tiny canoe.
You fold it and use your finger, make it like a little boat like this. And you put the drug in the middle. And then you light it. And then you smoke it with a straw.
In America, I think you'd call this freebasing. Also, when she says meth, she doesn't mean crystal meth. She means meth pills. They look like little pink aspirin, and they're called yaba, or crazy pills. That's mostly how meth is sold in Southeast Asia. You buy some pills, cook them up, and they give off this intoxicating vapor. Now, just to be clear, no one is getting high today. Ging is now clean. She just turned 40, and she looks healthy, with bright eyes and hair dyed with golden streaks. But Ging was once a semi-regular user.
You get this amazing power from methamphetamine. You go to work, but you feel joy. That weight is just lift away. And for women, you know, it keeps you skinny. Because you just keep partying and you never eat.
In 2014, the cops raided Ging's house and found her stash. Now, the police only discovered two pills, and that's really nothing, a street value of about $5. Yet for that tiny amount, Ging caught an 8-year prison sentence, reducible to 4 for good behavior. They went extra hard on her because, according to the cops, she had drug-smoking equipment, meaning that little piece of foil.
This is what it was, a straw made from foil that come out of the cigarette pack, and a lighter. That was our so-called equipment. I was like, why you are giving me 4 years over just two pills?
Ging didn't have the money to bribe the cops or lawyer up. So she got tossed in a prison cell with 300 other women. She says it's too crowded in there for two-person cells, or even beds. So inmates just pile up on the floor, practically spooning, as close, she says, as teeth in the mouth of a fish. I ask if there was much snoring. That, she says, is the least of it.
Oh, snoring? God, the sounds coming out of everywhere. Like, you know, snoring sound, and like those sound coming out of people's butts. Every type of sound you can imagine, you know, like women doing stuff with other women. You just have to put up with it.
I got permission to visit one of these facilities, the Chonburi Female Correctional Institution, a former men's prison recently cleared out to make room for women. It's just a few hours from Bangkok and just a few miles from the beach. I get patted down, put through the metal detector, and the first thing I notice when I get inside is that none of the guards have weapons. I mean, this is a prison, right? I've been to concerts with more security. I'm being escorted around by the warden's second-in-command. Her name is Supacha Sangtong, and she's a 29-year-old officer with a ponytail and braces. She takes me into this massive cement courtyard. Then, when the inmates notice us standing there, they all fall to their knees and clasp their hands. Sawadee ka. That's the polite female greeting in Thai. Everywhere we go, the kitchen, the commissary, this keeps happening. When we approach, the inmates drop to the floor and bow their heads. It happens again. And again. At one point, we run into the warden, a woman named Jurai Tasa, while she's patrolling the grounds. And I ask her about all the kneeling.
This is just Thai culture. If superiors or your elders come by, they know how to greet us properly and show respect.
The warden says, look, you can't compare this place to some Hollywood prison movie with all the gangs and the stabbing. It just isn't like that. Honestly, I did imagine it would be a little rougher than this. Supacha tells me, yeah, when I first got hired, I also expected it to be more hardcore.
I was really afraid at first, but when I got inside, I saw that it wasn't so scary. The female prisoners aren't violent. They're peaceful and obedient.
Think about it, though. Why should we expect these women to be aggressive? Only 2% of Thai female inmates committed violent crimes. Most inmates are like Ging. More than 80% are drug offenders. They're not in here because they hurt anyone. Most just got caught getting high. Once you see that these women are harmless, Supacha says, you start to wonder, what is the point of locking them up?
For a drug addict, the only punishment should be going somewhere to get medical treatment, just like any other person who's sick.
It's not like Thailand has some special agenda to jail women. The cops lock up loads of men, too. The problem is that Thailand has absorbed an ideology from the U.S., one that says anyone who does drugs belongs in a cage. This global war on drugs started with President Nixon.
It is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive.
It got supercharged in the 80s by Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
There's no moral middle ground. Indifference is not an option.
And it continues today.
You're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our families.
The U.S. has spent more than $1 trillion on its drug war and exported tactics and policies from Latin America to Asia. Here in Thailand, anti-drug units have been trained by the U.S. for decades, and its sentencing laws for so-called crazy pills or meth. They look a lot like U.S. sentencing for crack cocaine. And yet, the war on drugs isn't working here either.
You are trying to be like us. That's not good. And then when you look at the situation with women, it's even more horrifying. You have the highest rate of females incarcerated in the world. That is not to be proud of.
That's Dr. Carl Hart, a neuropharmacologist from Columbia University. He's possibly the best-known drug war critic in the world. Here, he's actually talking to a room full of senior Thai judges and cops, the very people charged with carrying out the drug war. And you'd think they might boo him, but no. Senior justice officials actually stood up and asked questions like this.
We put a lot of people in jail, but it seems that we're losing war on drug. My question is that, based on the scientific approach, should we legalize drugs?
Legalize drugs. That's how some Thai officials are talking these days, even the ones who've spent their careers locking people up. Officials like Pitya Jinawat, a veteran anti-narcotics officer, and now a top policy advisor to the Ministry of Justice. He's got buddies in the American DEA, and he's got lots of drug raids under his belt.
How has that worked out, that U.S.-style, tough, shoot 'em, lock 'em up approach?
Hin tap ya, yok ya, then it go again.
Hin tap ya. It means like a stone on top of the grass. You push down on the grass, a.k.a. the drug trade, with overwhelming force. But as soon as you let up the pressure and lift that rock, the grass always grows back. Pitya belongs to a sort of insurrection within the Thai justice system, this group of officials who say it's time to admit defeat and end the drug war.
You should not put people into the jail, into the criminal justice process. No.
He says they're even ready to part company with the DEA and risk America's condemnation.
You're not afraid of the DEA?
No, no. We can stand by our feet. No problem.
This pushback against the drug war in Thailand, it's just getting started. So far, they've only succeeded in amending a few harsh laws. These reforms have a long way to go. And that is where female prisoners come in. The strategy, Pitya says, is to start by highlighting the plight of female drug offenders, because they think society will be more sympathetic towards women, which will build compassion for all drug offenders and hopefully usher in better laws. That brings us back to Ging. Here she is on the outskirts of Bangkok, sweeping up trash at a local rec center, because this is the best job an ex-con can get. That is the most insidious part of this drug war, she says. Eventually, you get out of that awful cell, but the stigma follows you forever.
Why
cannot you move beyond your criminal path? Because people won't give us a chance.
For the World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok, Thailand.
Three millimeters each year is the average amount sea levels have been rising globally over the last 25 years, and that's likely to speed up as the planet heats up. Many coastal communities are already feeling the impacts of more erosion. Here in the World, we've been reporting recently on one of those communities, Haysborough, England. Homes and businesses on its eroding cliffs are already being lost to the North Sea. Today, our Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler has her final story from the village. It's a somewhat surprising tale of a couple, a midlife crisis, and a move to the other side of the world.
Teddy Kane got the idea about 15 years ago that he wanted to move his family from their home on the English coast to Australia. His wife Lizzie chalks it up to a midlife crisis.
Especially because you only saw Australia on a news clip. We had no friends, no family, we'd never been.
Didn't know where it was, even did we?
Well, you knew where it was, but that was it.
Lizzie's curled up next to Teddy on the couch in their kitchen while we talk. He gets more existential when trying to explain his motivations.
How do you know where you are is the best you can achieve or the best for your family necessarily? There's always something else that maybe you have to find or go in search for.
That something else turned out to be Australia, and Lizzie started looking into visas.
So I just thought, I'll make a few inquiries, tell him I've done that, keep him sweet, and then it won't come to anything and we'll be good.
But Teddy is a carpenter. He made the light blue cabinets with forks and spoons for handles that are in their kitchen. And when his wanderlust struck, Australia needed carpenters. That's what he'd seen on the news. So Teddy, Lizzie, and two of their kids, they actually got visas to move to Australia.
And then you think you've got to go because you spent a lot of money and time and investment in these visas.
They put their carefully decorated house in Haysborough up for sale, but at a bad time in the housing market, it just sat there for a year and a half.
You couldn't sell a house in Haysborough at the time because of the negative press coverage about the erosion. So we rented the house out, packed a suitcase, and we went.
This was about 6 years ago. They settled in Adelaide, enrolled their daughter in school, found work, and enjoyed the sun for 3 years.
Our life out there was nice. We were having a nice time, but then we realised it wasn't any better, was it? You do miss your friends and family and your ties, don't you?
Yeah. I didn't like renting a house out there because I like to do my own stuff in our house. I was getting a little bit itchy feet, really.
So, all of these things I did point out you could have thought of before we went. But never mind. We're still married. We came back and we're actually glad we didn't sell our house because had we sold it, we wouldn't have been able to afford to buy it back.
Here's the irony of the story. Coastal erosion has destroyed the homes of dozens of Haysborough residents in the past few decades and is threatening many more. But for the Canes, it did the opposite. They say it saved their home for them to come back to.
So that's the silver lining, really.
Lizzie and Teddy live far enough inland that they expect their house to long outlast them, and they say they're back for good.
Coming back here, it really dawned on me how I missed architecture, because in Australia there was nothing over 180 years old. Our church is like 400 or 500 years old. It's just a lovely, idyllic little place to be.
Yeah.
Love it here, don't we?
Yeah, you've done it now, haven't you? You've scratched the itch.
I jokingly say Italy next.
And then I do say we'll get divorced. I'm not doing it again.
Good for ice cream, though.
I'm not doing it again.
There's a sign on the Canes TV stand that says, "A man travels the world over in search of what he needs and returns home to find it." Lizzie put it up after they got back from Australia, in case Teddy sees any news stories about Italy needing carpenters. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Haysborough, England.
To hear from a family with a very different story about coastal erosion in Haysborough, just head over to PRI.org. A tragedy has shaken Canada, and it is no exaggeration to say the entire nation is in mourning. On Friday afternoon, a tractor-trailer crashed into a bus carrying a youth hockey team in Western Canada, killing 15 people on board that bus. The team is the Humboldt Broncos, based in the small town of Humboldt, Saskatchewan. We reached out to Bruce Dobigan to talk about this. He's a sports journalist based in Calgary, which is an 8-hour drive from the crash site. Bruce, what do we know about why the crash happened?
It's still a bit of a mystery. We've seen pictures of the crash site, but the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have yet to announce what exactly happened. We see some skid marks on the road. We see the front of the bus destroyed, the back of the truck destroyed, so we can make some conclusions from that. We know that the people who died in the bus were at the front of the bus. There were some trees that maybe obscured the view a little bit. We also know that this intersection had an accident at some point in the past in which I think 6 or 8 people were killed. So clearly it's problematic. It's been problematic in the past. But more than that, we don't know. The truck driver has lived. No evidence yet that they're going to charge him.
These deaths, though, I mean, this really strikes right at the heart of Canada. And I'd like it if you can just help us understand what youth hockey really means in Canada. I mean, for small communities, it's like glue, isn't it?
I think it's blood and bone. And at this level, these are young men. So people understand this is like an apprenticeship to try to play professional hockey. And these young men, I think, came from 3 of the provinces across the west of Canada. And they're basically, their parents give them up or let them go to a small town. Oftentimes these small towns and cities may have, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 people in them. And these young men live with billets in these cities. And so they have 2 families, which is part of the tragedy, is their own family loses them, but all of the billet, also the billet families. They're between the ages of 16 and 21, and they play on these hockey teams and, you know, go around the West, throughout Canada, as a matter of fact, throughout Northern Ontario, Quebec, the Maritimes, and even down to the Northern United States, there's junior teams that play and ride in these buses. There's a whole culture about it that people have celebrated for a long time. And this is the way, if you want to be a professional hockey player, you go about it. And so many of the great stars, this is their story, that they rode these buses.
So these are kids who probably began their lives playing on little ponds frozen over and just got enthused about the sport and just went on to this youth hockey league. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it would be the equivalent of an American kid wanting to play baseball or NFL football or NBA basketball. You know, from the time you're 5 or 6 years old, you hear about it, you want to do it. You know, the romantic days of playing on the frozen slough like Gordie Howe are probably in the past now. Almost all of these kids grow up playing indoors. Mm. But other than that, the romance, what you said is absolutely true.
I mean, it is so innate to Canada. I was looking online that there's a scene of children playing ice hockey on a pond on the last issue of your $5 bill. And there's even this quote by Quebecois writer Roch Carrier: "The winters of my childhood were long, long seasons. We lived in 3 places, the school, the church, and the skating rink. But our real life was on the skating rink." I mean, there's no sport of any kind on any American currency. So I feel that says a lot.
Well, I did a book a while ago called The Stick, and literally it was an entire book about the hockey stick, the making of it, the symbolism of it, the uses of it, etc. It's hard to believe you could do a whole book about a stick. And I had exactly that same picture on the front cover of my book, which was a frozen lake and people playing on a frozen lake. In the old days, of course, you would fashion your sticks from the trees that grew around you. It was a very natural scene. It was a very organic scene. And so it is bred into Canada. It's bred into our culture.
So how tight-knit were the Broncos?
Well, any time you have a team, and this would be, I guess I should point out as well, that they do ride buses all the time. College programs in the United States, they will fly now a fair bit. But these young men literally spend the entire winter on that bus. Each guy would have had his own seat. He would have customized the space for himself. There would have been things they did to while away the hours. Again, it's hard for people who live, let's say, in the northeast of the United States or in Britain or in Europe to fathom the distances that people travel in the West and think nothing of it. These kids might go into Manitoba and it would be a 10, 12-hour bus ride. So they had to kill the time and they had to have a culture inside. And it would have made them very, very close as a group.
Inside this very dark cloud is one small silver lining. One of the players who died, named Logan Boulay, was actually an organ donor, right?
Yeah, and he'd only just recently signed his donor card, which is obviously good for everybody to hear and to remember and to do that for themselves, because we never know when these kind of things can happen. Yeah. I think one of the young men, his father, at least one of the young men, his father played in the NHL. That's everything to these kids. It's part of a cultural mosaic that goes back 100 years, and everyone talks about it and everyone lives it. And especially in these small towns, I've been to them many times as I travel around the prairies. And the rink and the kids who play on that team, they're superstars in a small town.
How has this affected the mood across Canada, Bruce? Like, what are you seeing and hearing both from small towns and from big cities?
Well, you know, obviously the grief is genuine. There's a guy who goes on our hockey broadcasts on Saturday nights. He's the sort of almost Howard Cosell of hockey. His name is Don Cherry, and everyone waited to see how he was, and he was emotionally distraught. He's in his 80s, used to coach junior teams. He was distraught because he understood everything about it. He kind of echoed everyone's feelings here in Canada about the sense of loss and, you know, the risk that, you know, driving through the dead of winter, long winter nights, bad roads, and the fact that we haven't had more of these kind of accidents, I suppose, is a blessing. The other part that's been really gratifying for Canadians has been the outpouring from the president, President Trump, from the Queen of England, from people all around the world. Mm. You know, Saskatchewan is nowhere for a lot of people in the world. If you live in Saskatchewan, you think you're living just on the outside of society sometimes. And to find out that so many people care about you has been really gratifying.
Bruce Dobigan is the author of The Stick, as well as The Meaning of Puck, How Hockey Explains Modern Canada. Bruce, our condolences to you, and thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you. And again, thank you to all the people who are sympathizing with us and sending your best wishes. It means a lot to us.
We wanted to end today's show on this note. This is new music from Algeria, a band called Imarhan.
أبو قد جيتني دق ورتني زي.
This is Imarhan, five-piece band of Tuareg musicians from the Algerian desert city of Tamanrasset. The title of their just released CD is Temet, which means connection in their Tamashek language, as in every human is connected in some way to another. No person is an island. That's where we leave things for you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.